From WGCU News, I'm John Davis. For many Americans, the upcoming Labor Day holiday is little more than a chance to relax and enjoy a three-day weekend. But its historical intent is to recognize the creation of the labor movement and the social and economic achievements of American workers. This week's encore essay from News Press storyteller Amy Bennett Williams recounts her unlikely friendship with a prominent international labor organizer who helped create the United Auto Workers Union back in the 1930s and who happened to spend part of the year here in Southwest Florida.
I don't remember when I started hearing the whispers that the great man lived right down the road from me. Frankly, I was skeptical. So I stopped in at the United Auto Workers Retirees Office on Colonial Boulevard in Fort Myers to ask if it were true. The sweet-faced woman behind the desk just stared. She wasn't sure she'd ever heard the name before. It didn't ring a bell. You know, Victor Reuther, one of the UAW's pioneers, Walter's brother? I asked. It was hard to believe she didn't know the name of the man who, with his brothers Walter and Roy, helped create the union in the 1930s, the man who roused and rallied striking auto workers, the man who worked to restore Europe's trade unions after World War II. What a trio! Walter, the public figure, the nationally influential UAW president, Roy, in charge of the union's legislative affairs, and Victor, its education and international director. But no, she didn't know who he was, and she couldn't tell me whether or not Victor Reuther lived in Lee County. It hadn't even occurred to me to look in the phone book, so certain was I he'd have an unlisted number. But believe it or not, his name was right there. What's more, he answered the phone with a hail hello when I called. How to explain that I just wanted to meet him? It was one of the few times in my life when I couldn't use the "I'd like to write a story" strategy as a means to that end. I was doing time editing a glossy Naples magazine, and I knew better than to pitch a piece about an unflagging social and labor activist who lived in the Buckingham Woods. But somehow I muddled through telling him, truthfully, that I had two friends who were great admirers of his as well, and maybe we could just all go to lunch. He'd love to, he said. He and his wife, Sophie, had another week here in Florida before they returned to their home in D.C. How about the farmer's market? It must have given the regulars a turn, the gathering at our table that day, a silver-haired physician in a houndstooth suit, two younger people, and a bespectacled old man singing vigorous labor hymns while we tried not to choke on our okra. The conversation that day ranged from how it felt to be shot in the face. Like his brother Walter, Victor had survived an assassination attempt. It cost him an eye and the use of one arm. To the decline of unions, to the massive Brahma cattle once common in these parts. He was fascinated, he said, by their size and their eyes. After the last plate was cleared, he gathered us all in a quick hug and proposed that we do it again next year. We'll call ourselves the Young Hellraisers, Victor said. And we did, meeting for a few more memorable meals before Sophie took ill, and he invited the Hellraisers to reconvene at his house back in the jungle along the Orange River. I don't want to leave my dear Sophie for hours at a time, he said, and it was clear the very idea pained him. Yet if Sophie was sick that night we gathered at the Orange River, it was hard to tell. She'd cooked magnificently, shredded cabbage and pierogies, stir-fried greens, and delicate meatballs. We all complimented her, none so lavishly as Victor, who obviously adored her. He poured big glasses of Concha y Toro wine, a recent discovery with which he was delighted, he said. I like it because it comes in nice big bottles. Glasses in hand, we wandered the property as he pointed out a screech owl hole filled with babies, the woodwork his brother Walter had created for the house, and finally he led us to his sprawling garden, crowned with a strapping clump of greens. "Do you know what these are?" he asked. Now, I'm an inveterate gardener, but I admit I was stumped. Bending as spryly as a kid, our octogenarian tour guide tugged and tugged as something grudgingly emerged from the sandy soil. He held it out proudly, a bright white baseball bat of a thing. "Daikon," he declared, producing a pocket knife to deftly carve it into saucer-sized slices. He handed me some. I bit. The daikon crunched like a carrot, but once on the palate, bloomed into a succession of flavors, spicy, faintly salty, bitter at the bottom, but pleasingly so, its tongue-tingling piquancy paired with surprising sweetness. When we said our goodbyes at the end of the evening, I could still taste it. I never saw Victor or Sophie again. She died the following year, and after that, Victor preferred to stay in Washington. But he'd mail me typewritten letters every now and then, this world-changing man who had no earthly reason to spend time telling me how his next book was coming or that the leaves were turning. And sometimes we'd talk on the phone until he moved into a nursing home and we lost track of each other. He died in D.C. in 2004. And though a supermarket is perhaps an odd place for such memories, I think of Victor every time I pass a now fashionable daikon, earthy, sweet, and rousingly strong.